Good morning and welcome to The Cosmic Influence. My name's Walter Cruttenden, and I'm here with co-host Jeff Patino.
How are y'all?
And as most of you know, we work at the Binary Research Institute here in California, where we look at the whole ancient idea that history or consciousness moves in cycles. This is something that Plato called the Great Year. And it's been documented that over 30 ancient cultures believed in this idea that we would have alternating dark and golden ages that had something to do with the motion of the stars. Some of them tied it to the precession of the equinox. Others just simply mentioned motion of the heavens. But it's an idea that I think is not taught in schools, in that they generally believe that this idea of cycles is in a long-lost golden age is a fairy tale, but that we're finding increasing evidence for. And this is coming through the archaeological record, where we're digging up things that seem out of place, such as geared devices we thought weren't developed until the great clockmaking era, and then we found the Antikythera device that dates to, you know, at least 1,000 years before that. Or the battery, supposedly invented by Volta in 1700, and we actually found a more sophisticated battery than that that goes back 2,000 years earlier to Baghdad, and other things, dentistry, orthodontics, building materials, knowledge of mathematics, things like this. It seems that the ancients knew a lot more than we have given them credit for. So in this quest, we interview various people that can sort of speak to the idea of the cycle. And normally we're interviewing people that, you know, have a specific knowledge of archaeology or anthropology or some aspect of an ancient culture. And this time we're going to have some fun because we're going to talk to a futurist. And his name is John Peterson. He's a futurist with the Arlington Institute. And Jeff, can you give a little background on John?
Sure. John is considered by many to be one of the most informed futurists in the world. He's best known for writing and thinking about high-impact surprises, wild cards, and the process of surprise anticipation. His current professional involvements include the development of sophisticated tools for anticipatory analysis and surprise anticipation, long-range strategic planning, and helping leadership design new approaches for dealing with the future.
That sounds great. And John, you on the line there?
I'm here.
Good to have you here.
It's nice to be here.
This is an area that's always fascinated me because the future is changing so fast right now that it seems like we can hardly keep up with it. And I want to get into that, and I know you've spoken extensively on this topic. But first of all, can you just tell me kind of what is a futurist? Because this is a job occupation most of us aren't familiar with.
Well, it's an interesting question. I guess there's, last time I heard somebody talk about it, something like 5,000 different graduate programs that have something to do with studying the past history, and there's only two or three of them in the world that have anything to study about what might happen in the future. And that's what futurists do, is to try to systematically try to understand, project, develop alternatives of the future. The common kind of approach. The common approach is to do projections, and many people in the business also do scenarios, alternative pictures, alternative projections. But the whole business of studying the future in a systematic and professional way is particularly important these days, when you have high rates of time, high rates of change, and the potential for really extraordinary kind of events that really are not predictable nor have any precedent that gives any indication that they might be coming along.
Okay. And from what I've read, many futurists specialize in specific areas, like Ray Kurzweil, technology, and others in economics. But you're trying to just focus on the whole enchilada here, is that correct?
Yeah, we're a nonprofit that the Arlington Institute, which I set up, and so unlike most futurists who have to make a living working for somebody, they become focused on economics or technology, as you suggest, or other kind of areas, healthcare. And the thing that makes us kind of unique is that we look at the whole world and try to understand in very broad and very deep terms what is happening from a systems point of view, what is happening and what might be causing all of this and where we might be all going.
Good. Well, that's what we're interested in. We're interested in the big picture, sort of, you know, what's happening to consciousness and how will our history be different in the next 100 years than it was in the last 100 years. And I guess the one thing I've learned from reading some of your material, by the way, John's an author of several books, including his latest, A Vision for 2012. And this isn't the Maya 2012, but this is just looking out roughly 5 years or so. And, you know, give us a little bit of that vision, if you would.
Well, the way, Walter, the way I approach this, which makes it kind of different from most futurists, is that I look at this in conventional and unconventional terms. The conventional terms would be looking at the trends we're all familiar with and we all hear and read about, hear on the news, read about in the papers and on the web. Things about energy and social trends and financial disruption and climate change and all of those kinds of things. And I think it's important that you understand all of that. You have to see, and it's not enough to, in general, understand it, but to see it in terms of a system and how the different pieces interact with and connect to each other and how the system might behave in different kind of ways, because what we live in, of course, is an extraordinarily complex non-linear system. And what that means is that it exhibits behavior that essentially is unpredictable and has rapid shifts. We've all heard of tipping points and such. And so you get abrupt, disruptive behavior in these kinds of complex systems. And for the most part, certainly from conventional understanding, it's hard to anticipate when it is going to shift stages or phases. At the same time, it seems to me that there is an unconventional aspect of what we're experiencing here that is not obvious in terms of the conventional kind of indicators. The conventional indicators, you could argue, are byproducts, are derivatives of the unconventional things. There's something deeper and far more profound that is driving this whole system. And I guess the kind of fundamental question that I think about in this is, do you think that life is random or it has some direction? And if you think it's random, then the rest of this conversation isn't going to make much sense to you. But if you think it has some direction, if you think there's a purpose to life, if you think all of what we've been through is headed in some general or maybe even specific direction, then you have to start to ask the questions about, well, what is that and how is it influenced and is there somebody smarter than me who's influencing and directing all of this, and what are the indicators and where's the history that we might access that would give us some sense of what is happening in other dimensions, if you will, or other areas that are not obvious, because the conventional things are pretty obvious. And I'm driven into this unconventional space for a number of reasons, not least of which is that you cannot explain what is going on here in terms of big conventional things, just in the usual kind of ways. I don't think, for instance, that all of the big changes that are happening right now, financial shift, changes in the environment and the climate, the beginning of the end of the era of petroleum, of the species die-off, huge kind of water problems, population higher than it's ever been, and so on. All these things are not just coincidental. They're not just happening all at the same time. And so what we do is try to look and say, well, what is it? What else is going on here? Is there a larger level of intelligence that is part of all of this? And I've come to the very clear opinion that, in fact, there is far more at play than what meets the eye, and that all of this change that we're going through is only part of a dramatic, epical shift in the evolution of our species, literally, on this planet. And that has been talked about and prophesied and indicated and written and scratched on walls and for ages and ages from all kinds of groups and shamans and prophets and indigenous groups and wisdom traditions and psychics and intuitives and channels and all kinds of sources, all unconventional in our modern way of thinking, but all point to this likelihood that something really quite substantial is happening now that is certain in one way or another to fundamentally change the way we live on this planet.
Well, I want to get into that more, but I want to also just tell our listeners that John sounds like a little bit of a mystic here and bringing in sort of, you know, the shamanistic qualities. And yet, John, you've done work for the military, for large corporations. I really don't think of you as sort of, you know, coming from the hippie side of things. You really taken a disciplined approach to looking at trends, haven't you?
Well, absolutely. I've worked in the White House. I've done a lot of things for the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, and for the government of Singapore. We built them a national surprise anticipation center, which is the first ever capability of that kind in the world. I've worked in high-tech areas and, run and started up companies that work in these areas. So, yes, sure. We understand as well as anybody on the planet, perhaps, the mechanisms of how you think about and then try to anticipate surprises, and we come at that often, almost exclusively from a conventional point of view. But it seems to me, in terms of the context of what you're interested in and what your listeners are interested in, that there's something a lot bigger here, and that all intrigues me a great deal.
Yeah, me too. And to put this in sort of a timeline, I was listening to one of your videos on your website, which, by the way, is an excellent website, and I would encourage our listeners to visit. That's John Peterson Arlington Institute. You can just Google that and get to him. But you mentioned
SEN, by the way, Peterson SEN.
Good point. You were mentioning that your grandfather was born in 1900. Mine happened to have been born in 1901. And both our grandfathers saw the first cars, the first movies, the first airplanes, the first TVs, on and on and on and on. And, you know, that's just barely 100 years ago. All these changes have taken place. And the pace of change, of course, is just accelerating at an exponential rate. Can you speak to that a little bit about the pace of change? And
well, sure. Perhaps the guy who's thought more in concrete terms about this than anyone else is the futurist you mentioned, Ray Kurzweil, who is a friend of mine. Ray is an extraordinary inventor and thinker about technology and has done his homework better than anyone else, I think, in terms of evaluating historical and current trends in technology and trying to extrapolate that out into the future. What Ray says is that if present trends continue, that there will be 1,000 times the technological change in this 21st century as there was in the 20th century. And so in this last century where we went to the moon and the internet and started with horses and buggies and made all of those advancements, if you multiply that times 1,000 times, that's the trend line that we're running down. And no one can wrap their head around what that might be. And so I kind of broke it down and said, well, what might that be in the next 10 years? And in the next 10 years, that'd be probably 70 or 80 times the change of the whole last century. And what that means, by definition, necessarily, there will be fundamental shifts across the board in terms of energy and transportation and biology and all of the different areas of science. At very basic levels that underpin and support dramatic kind of changes downstream. I mean, take one very quick area of biotechnology. We're making such great strides in terms of replacement body parts for humans, artificial replacement parts. Those are called cyborgs, by the way, when you mix a human being and a machine in one sort or another. What science believes is by 2015, that's like 6 years from now, right, that every major organ in the body except the brain and the central nervous system will be replaceable by something artificial. And if you follow this, we produce a little free newsletter called Future Edition, which your readers might be interested in, and you can sign up for that at our website. But we look across the horizon, and we track the emergent kind of things that are happening in these areas. And if you sit at the nexus of all of these things, as I do, and try to edit and make sense out of it all, it just blows your mind, the extraordinary things that people are doing nowadays.
You know, I just, along those lines, I just read an article a few weeks ago about some scientists that had developed nano lattice that could actually grow cells, and then once whatever cell structure had grown that they wanted, they could actually dissolve the lattice.
Yes.
Which I thought was just incredible.
Yeah, I saw a film of that on the internet the other day. I've been following the regenerative medicine field, and I think our tendency is to think, oh, the cyborg is machine and cells, and what's going on is we're passing the machine state because we're, through regenerative medicine, companies like Cytori Therapeutics, they're growing the parts out of cells themselves, so they really will fit very nicely with the rest of the body.
But if you even just look at stem cell research, you can all of us remember when George Bush got all excited and said, no, we're never going to do any stem cell research in the United States because it came from embryos, and here we are a few short years later making it out of scratches from your fingernail or something like that. I mean, it's
right.
Just amazing how...
It is amazing. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Cosmic Influence. Yes, speaking of stem cells, they used to think you had to get them from embryonic sources to get the best ones, and then from bone marrow or, you know, difficult places.
Yeah.
And this latest Stanford paper out just a week ago or so says you can get these polypleural cells from adipose fat. And
well, we have an unlimited supply.
That's the truth. It is the truth. So there's some amazing things going on in all fields, and you are kind of at the nexus of this, aren't you? And trying to make sense of it.
Somewhat.
Yeah. So that that takes us to really what is going on behind the scenes, and you kind of hinted that, you know, maybe there's something bigger than us, and that really intrigued me, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay. Are we going?
We're going.
Sneaked up on me. The something bigger than us. Well, I don't know. If you think life is just
happened, a biological accident?
Yeah, if you just think it's a series. I once heard, one of these well-known astronomers talk about, and then there was an accident, and then there was an accident, and then there was an accident, just going through the history of evolution as he understood it, all of it punctuated by accidents. And somehow it doesn't seem reasonable to me. There's just too much extraordinary knowledge and information. I'm sitting here looking outside the window at a forest of trees out around my office, and to just think about the complexity and the elegance and all that is involved with that, just as it operates right now, to say nothing about the full kind of lifetime and all the seasons and how the synergies with everything else. It's hard for me to believe that all this just was an accident and isn't related to something larger. And I'm drawn in my research and thinking and to this, to some of the kind of wisdom traditions, and I guess in simplistic terms, the Native Americans talk about the Great Spirit, and history is full of all these indicators from sources going all the way back to ancient Greece that say that our life and our existence in this universe is a byproduct of a larger force, intelligent force, that is, and we are components of that larger force and that larger intelligence, and we are, our experiences are providing joy input to that force. I mean, our purpose in life is to evolve, and in this evolutionary process, we generate experiences that would not be otherwise available. That's big and arcane and kind of flat in terms of what it is, but it's in more kind of conventional terms, it's hard for me, just looking at the stars, to believe that we're the only one in the universe that has ever shown up like this, and that, in fact, it makes sense. I'm convinced that there are others that have gone through this process, and that we're being guided in from other dimensions. There are lots of indications that there are other dimensions, psychics, and lots of folks, remote viewers in the military, used to operate in some space where they could draw information from the future and see things locked up in a safe on the other side of the world. And science can't explain how that all works. So we're clearly not at the place where we fully understand the full dimensionality of this reality that we're in. And It's a little bit of hubris, it seems to me, to suggest that to believe that we really do, and that we're the smartest thing around, and there's everything else is less than we are. And by the way, we probably know most of everything there is to know already, which is what science seems to think or imply in most of the way they work these days. And so anyway, I'm at awe in all of this. I look at it all and am convinced that there's greater life and intelligence than all of this. And my guess is that there's a hierarchy, that there are angels and spirits and things all around us, and there are those entities that are responsible for large things like the planet, perhaps, or the solar system and such. I don't know. It's a little above my pay grade. It's it's interesting and necessarily complex, and certainly nothing that I remember, at least, having ever experienced.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful thought.
Well, and you know, we're fans of rational explanations for everything. I mean, that's how we base our technology, but when it comes down to it, the very fact that anything exists at all, at this point, from our understanding, has no rational explanation
whatsoever. Or when you just look out at the stars at night and consider that it goes on forever, you know, it just doesn't make sense in a rational world.
Well, and then the assumptions that we make, like that the physics that we measure in our limited kind of way is consistent everywhere in the universe. All of our astronomy, for instance, is based on the presumption that the basic laws of physics that we experience are the same everywhere that we can look. Well, who says? I mean, the weather isn't the same everywhere on the planet. Who says that the physics works the same everywhere? There are just a lot of really kind of basic fundamental things that say, well, hey, maybe the speed of light changes dramatically, or maybe space and time are folded on top of each other, and you look out here and it looks like a straight line and it really curves way back, and if you'd kind of just do a sidestep to the right, you might end up being out there where you'd think you're looking straight ahead. Anyway, I don't know.
You know, it's like we all live in a giant salad and we're stuck on one of the tomatoes and that's all we can see in any direction, so we assume that the whole universe is tomato when there's carrots and radishes and...
Well, there are, and more than that, they're all alive, you know, and they, you know, and they're changing, and they, it's kind of a moving target and highly dynamic, and if we get our act together, then we can change maybe space and time and the evolutionary rate. I mean, it's just, I think there's a great deal of...
Well, unfortunately, we can't change space-time quite at this moment, so we have to take a commercial break.
Hold that thought. It's difficult to talk about the big picture here. So, John, let's turn to some of the specifics where you've been doing work. You'd mentioned healthcare. Tell us about energy. That's something that's always on our minds.
Well, I'm particularly interested in energy. I come from an engineering background, and so an electrical engineering background, and so in one sense, that's relatively familiar to me, but what it appears to me is that we're on this edge of an extraordinary kind of transition. The production of petroleum, of oil on the planet, has been flat for the last 3 years, and it's that reasonable, thoughtful people have come to the conclusion, including some leaders in the oil industry, that we're not going to pump any more oil than we are right now. And what that has produced is a great deal of interest, as we all know, in alternative forms of energy and alternative methods of using energy. And what I've run into some things here lately that is really quite intriguing in terms of, you know, biomass, using biomass in order to produce both liquid and solid fuels. In particular, I've been working with some folks for a while around a plant called Arundo Donax. Arundo Donax is a grass plant that is like, if you saw it at a distance, you'd think it was bamboo, but it's the fastest growing, most dense plant on the planet. It grows 6 inches or 3 to 6 inches a day sometimes, and it grows up to 30 feet tall. And you can grow as many as 35,000 of these plants in an acre and produce an extraordinary amount of biomass, 35 tons per acre of this. And in warm climates, you can get 2 cuttings a year. And it turns out to be perennial, so that you cut it down and it grows again, and just like grass, like hay, you know. And there are methods whereby you can convert this into a charcoal kind of form that is directly usable and burnable in coal-fired power plants, so that, but it doesn't produce the sulfur and the mercury and the other kind of things when you burn it. You can produce oil from the process that can directly go into a refinery and produce result in aviation fuel and gasoline and diesel. And you can use it as an alternative for pulp and paper things in the paper business. And so you can replace wood, and you can replace coal, and you can replace oil from this. And then just last week in the L.A. area, I was out in near Fresno at a farm looking at a stand of a new kind of a hybrid tree that grows to 65 feet in 3 years. Sat there and walked around these 9 to 11 foot tall trees that were only 90 days, 3 months old, and I was there with some friends who had been there when they were only 24 inches or so, about a month and a half ago. And so there's an extraordinary biologist. This is called Emerald Energy. It's the company, and they call it Megaflora. But you have the ability here to grow this great deal of biomass, and these trees, too, are perennial, so that you can cut them off, and they regrow. And they have huge amounts of biomass that they can produce, and again, you can do the same kinds of coal replacement and liquid fuel replacement with them, but at the same time, they phytoremediate the ground that they are on. We were looking at a stand of 10 acres of these trees that were in what used to be a settling pond for the waste from a dairy farm, and so it was just old urine and manure and everything, and in about 6 months or so, it looks like that it will have completely cleared up all the waste and remediated the ground. So there are a number of these things that I've been finding that suggest in the near term, in the midterm in any way, that there are some direct replacements for digging holes in the ground and extracting coal and oil. And that's pretty intriguing.
Yeah, and it seems logical, too, that we certainly have the technology in many other areas, you know, in medicine and computers and things, that it shouldn't take too much of our brain power to solve the energy problem.
Well, our approach to this has been very, very mechanical, and it's a byproduct of the machine age, of course. And I think we're moving toward an area of biology and to where things are far less like steam engines in the way that we kind of think of do physical and mechanical kind of things. And so it seems to me that this biological kind of transition is a natural kind of predictable evolution.
Yes. And it's not out of line with the ancient idea on how things progress from a you know, just a material view. You just use what you seize in sort of a dark age mentality to an understanding that there's finer forces and energy in everything.
Right.
And you can begin to convert it. And so that's, it seems like a natural part of the unfolding trend here. I wanted to read a review or two about your book. I haven't finished it, but one said the book covers many scenarios of decline, examples and data showing us the rate of accelerating change, and many arguments for increasing resilience personally as a community and nationally. The changes we shall face on our journey we should consider moral and solvable. These issues are drastic, human, and not bound to political party. John's book creates a good introduction to the debate. We should use the debate together to develop a brighter future. Sounds like you got a lot of very nice reviews on your book, 2012. And is the book, it's a little dark starting off?
Well, you have to, you can't stop reading it in the first half. I mean, because I talk about breakdowns and breakthroughs, and the first half is about breakdowns, and if you stop it there, you'll get pretty depressed. And what you have to do is keep reading and read about all of the breakthroughs and the extraordinary kind of change, and then we try to build some scenarios about alternative worlds and where this might go. And some of what you could do, we could do as individuals and as institutions in order to deal with all of this and prepare ourselves.
We can repair ourselves, did you say, John?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think that there's extraordinary kind of opportunities along in ways that we've just never thought about. Somebody was trying to, was asking me the other day, I gave a talk at the Singularity University down at the NASA Ames in San Francisco area, and they were saying, just how could this new world be different than what we're already familiar with? And give us an example. They were kind of frustrated, and I said, well, maybe people won't eat in this new world. And they all said, well, that's crazy. Of course they'll eat. And I said, well, no, it's not crazy. I know somebody that doesn't eat, hasn't eaten for 6 months. In fact, I know two people who haven't. And so there seems to be a way in which a few individuals can do this. And so when you think about the possibility of really dramatic new change in this world and how you have to what you might need to prepare yourself for, then you need to really be kind of out of the box, but you really have to work the edges. This is change like we've never ever seen before.
Yeah, you know, I've read about a few of those people. Several of them are discussed in the book Autobiography of a Yogi by Paramahansa Yogananda, including Teresa Neumann, who only ate a wafer from the Catholic Church, you know, once a week. And reading the sort of the fine print, actually all of them say they're intaking energy. They're just just doing it a different way through a different medium. But I think that's far in the future, huh?
Well, we had this extraordinary dowser here, Raymond Grace, in our town of Berkeley Springs in West Virginia earlier this week, and he told the story of a fellow who, a friend of his, who puts the energy that he needs from the vegetables and other kinds of things into water, and all he does is drink water, and all he's done is drink water for, 9 months now. And so he kind of, in homeopathic terms, kind of puts the energy into the water. Well, a lot of folks would say that's impossible, but I don't know.
Yeah, at my present state of consciousness, and it being just about lunchtime,
yes.
I'm not for that future scenario. But I understand what you're saying, that there are possibilities that are almost inconceivable to us at the present age. Again, the ancient stories about the cycle, the ascending ages, after the material and then after the energy age is the Treta Yuga, what the Greeks called the Silver Age. And that's supposed to be a time of, mental, tremendous mental capacities, including the possibility of time travel.
Yes.
So tell it, what do you see in terms of modes of transportation then?
Well, I'm convinced that, in conventional terms, and certainly in the next 20 or 25 years or something like that, I mean, all other things being equal, even though I've suggested that they aren't, that we're headed toward an all-electric world, and the question is only how you generate the electricity. So whatever kind of, whether it's levitation or, electric cars or whatever it turns out to be, it's all about electricity, I think.
Yeah, that would seem to be an obvious thing going in that direction. In most of your work, John, you're just trying to look out generally, what, 5, 10, 20 years, or are you concerned?
Well, I think so. I have friends who spend a great deal of their time trying to guess what 1,000 years from now might be like, and I think, with all due respect, that's kind of a waste of time, because the rate of change is so great that if you could just figure out riding this exponential curve that's just screaming to the sky, if you could just figure out 20 years, that'd be enough to try to put some things in place or figure out what you've got to do in terms of becoming a new human being to live in this new world that's coming downstream.
Yeah. And I think it's incommunicable, too, to talk about 1,000 years out. You know, if you go back to a farmer just 100 years ago and you try to tell him about animation and iPods and, sending things wirelessly, it doesn't make sense to them.
Right. Even just trains that go 250 miles an hour or whatever they do is impossible to believe.
And even science fiction like Star Trek, a lot of people think it takes place way far in the future, but it actually takes place, here's my Star Trek nerd coming out, it takes place in the year 2260, which is not that far away when you think about it.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll be doing many of those things and more, and we'll look at Star Trek episodes as quaint and old-fashioned.
Well, we're very close to being able to have probes that will evaluate what all the diseases or something someone has. There's a lot of things that are getting pretty close to that.
And my cell phone does more than a communicator ever did on the show, so.
That's true. So how do we use this information? The world's moving so fast. Can we use it?
The bottom line, I think, is that we've got to become a new human being. This is a punctuation in the evolution of the species, as I said, is what it appears to me. And that means that we have to become, if you're going to be a player, if you're going to be around to populate and build the new world that comes along from the new human beings, then you have to become a new human being. You have to become something new. And I guess, what makes sense to me is that you have to learn how to operate in these alternative dimensions and see the world in much, much broader terms and be co-creative and help to manifest this new reality.
I'd say amen to that. We do need to be co-creative. We can't just be living in our old-fashioned world hoping that the rest of the world gets better. It's when we change that everything starts to change. And unfortunately, we're near the end of our time here.
But let me give out your website really quick. It's www.arlingtoninstitute.org.
And, John, I find your field of study just fascinating. I hope we can get you at our CPAC conference.
I hope some of your listeners will sign up for the newsletter for future edition.
Terrific. Okay. Thanks for being on the show. And
nice to be with you both.
We'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, that was a fascinating show, Walter.
Needless to say, yes, I wish some of our audience could have heard some of the things he was saying off screen or, off mic. He's a deep and fascinating guy.
So once again, if you'd like more information about the Binary Research Institute, you can visit the website at www.binaryresearchinstitute.org. And also don't forget the CPAC conference is coming up. And that website is www.cpaconline.com.
It's coming up on October 10th at UCI, the Beckman National Academy of Sciences Conference Center. And I hope to see you all there.
CPAC 2009. Check it out.
Great. And in the meantime,
bring on the higher ages.